Good afternoon. My name is Lindsay, and I will be your conference operator today. At this time, I would like to welcome everyone to the AUCD webinar conference call. All lines have been placed on mute to prevent any background noise. After the speaker's remarks, there will be a question-and-answer session. If you would like to ask a question during this time, simply press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. If you would like to withdraw your question, press the pound key. Thank you, Ms. Suen. You may begin your conference.
Thank you so much, Lindsay, and welcome everyone. I wanted to extend a welcome from the Association of University Centers on Disabilities to this afternoon or this morning in some parts of the country, this webinar that is going to be presenting some findings from a research topic of interest of two specific projects that have been funded through AUCD's cooperative agreement with the National Center on Birth Defects and Developmental Disabilities at CDC. I want to take folks through a very brief introduction, and we'll get to the speakers very, very quickly, because I know that all of you are very interested on what folks out in Rochester and Colorado have to share from their RTOI projects. But let me just briefly introduce our speakers this afternoon. We are joined, as I said, by two RTOI projects that have looked at the Down syndrome and the prevalence of autism spectrum disorder in children with Down syndrome. And they looked at diagnosis and prevalence within this population. We're joined this afternoon by Dr. Cordelia Robinson. Dr. Robinson is the director of the JFK Partners, which is the RUCED out in Colorado. Also with her is Dr. Susan Hepburn, and Dr. Hepburn is the assistant professor of psychiatry at University of Colorado in Denver, and she's also the director of research at JFK Partners. From Rochester, we have Dr. Susan Hyman, and she's the chief of the Division of Neurodevelopmental and Behavioral Pediatrics and an associate professor of pediatrics at the Children's Hospital at Strong and the University of Rochester School of Medicine and Dentistry. Along with Dr. Hyman is, and I apologize, Edwin, if I do not pronounce your name correctly, is Dr. Edwin Van Wingengarten, who is the assistant professor at the Department of Community and Preventive Medicine, of Preventative Medicine and Environmental Medicine at University of Rochester Medical Center. And they will be presenting the results of their research on these RTOI projects. I think some of you may have joined us last year. Towards the end of September, Dr. Robinson, Dr. Hepburn, and Dr. Hyman had shared some of their preliminary results from their RTOI projects. And we're just very excited that they have since wrapped up their projects on June 30th of this year. And we're very eager to learn about the findings that they have found through their study. We're also joined this afternoon by Dr. Diane Schendel, our discussant, and she has been the scientific collaborator from NCBDDDD on this project. And we look forward to her comments on this research project as well. Let me just go over very briefly about our cooperative agreement. The goals of the cooperative agreement are listed out in the bullets. Our main priority is to strengthen the nation's capacity to carry out public health and disability activities. And we do that through fostering collaboration among members of the AUCD network and the National Center on Birth Defects and Developmental Disabilities. We've added additional components to this cooperative agreement, such as providing technical assistance to state disability and health grantees funded through CDC. We also strengthen expertise in the field of birth defects and developmental disabilities through the training of professionals in public health and related fields. And as some of you are familiar with our RTOI research topic of interest mechanism, we facilitate a range of research, education, and dissemination activities through this cooperative agreement. Okay. I wanted to just give you briefly an overview of all the types of research topics of interest project that have taken place so far. And they have been in a multitude of public health areas, including health communication, education, prevention of secondary conditions, quality of life studies, health promotion interventions, and comorbidity prevalence studies, such as this one that you're going to hear from this afternoon. And the disabilities areas that have spanned this, all of these projects include autism, Down syndrome, Duchenne muscular dystrophy, epilepsy, Fragile X syndrome, hearing loss, fetal alcohol syndrome, spina bifida, and Tourette syndrome. I wanted to give you all a pictures of our speakers this afternoon. I have often heard comments about being able to connect and put a picture to the voice that you're listening to and provide you with the photos of each of our speakers this afternoon. Before I pass it over to the folks out in Colorado, I wanted to let all of you know, just repeat what the operator has said. All of your lines are muted during the presentation. There will be a question and answer session that the operator will facilitate and provide you with instructions on. But those of you who are on the webinar and know that at the very bottom that there's actually an instant text messaging function that allows you to enter the questions that you want to ask the speakers as they're coming to you. And that can be done at any point throughout the webinar. And Carla Kometz, who's our project specialist on the AUCD and CBDDD cooperative agreement, will be collecting all of those questions and posing them to our speakers at the question and answer period. So at this point, I'm going to be transferring the microphone with the controls to the folks in Colorado and get started with the RTOR webinar. So folks out in Colorado, Susan and Corey, are you folks ready to go?
We are.
Okay, great.
Okay. Well, thank you, Sue Lynn, and I want to express our appreciation for having this opportunity. As Sue Lynn indicated, both of our studies looked at children with Down syndrome and whether there's an association with the occurrence of autism. Okay. And the reasons why it's important to look at this comorbidity, we feel, is the potential for understanding the neurobiology of autism, phenotypic symptoms of autism, in conjunction with phenotypic symptoms of Down syndrome. Also, the ability to look at the appropriate services for children with both diagnoses, determine strategies for screening, and to better understand the children and access to appropriate support mechanisms for families. And so in our study, next one, we have three aims. I'm going to review the first two aims, and then Susan is going to discuss the third aim. So our first aim was to conduct a population-based epidemiological study of the prevalence of autism spectrum disorders in children with Down syndrome. We had a couple recruitment strategies, and geographic and demographic requirements for the population. So we worked with our Department of Public Health and Environment, which maintains a birth registry, and letters of invitation were sent to families of children with Down syndrome who were born between January 1, 1996 and December 31, 2003, while the mother was residing in one of the 10 counties that in Colorado are considered to be part of the Front Range. We also publicized the study through the Mile High Down Syndrome Society, and they sent it out to their full membership. And then families who responded through either mechanism were offered a screening test for social communication and behavioral difficulties and the possibility of a follow-up diagnostic evaluation. So we thought it simplest to present the numbers from the birth registry as the way we got to our sample that we wound up working with. So in that period of time in Colorado, in those 10 counties, a total of 497 children were born. Before letters were sent, the birth certificate and death certificate matching was done, and we learned that 55 of those children were deceased. So letters were sent to 442 families. 150 came back as undeliverable. So we assume that 292 letters were delivered, and out of that we had a yield of 124 families responding to us. There were other families who called, but who didn't meet the demographic or geographic characteristics. So working from those that were deliverable, we had a 42.5% response rate. This next slide, this slide shows you some comparison of the people who did respond to the people who did not respond to our invitation. So as you can see, for the responders, the mothers were a little bit older, a little bit more years of average years of education. They were more likely to be white, non-Hispanic, with 82% of the responders being in that group. White Hispanic accounted for another 12%. And so these are significantly different than the percentages for the non-responders. The difference, the responders were more likely to be male, but that was not a significant difference. They were more likely to be born later. So those last two rows show you the percent of those we heard from who were born in the first birth year versus the next to last birth year. So a younger population among our responders. When a family contacted the project, they turned out to be eligible. A screening was done on the phone using either the MChat or the SCQ, depending upon the child's age. All those families whose child screened positively for risk of autism spectrum disorders were invited in for a full evaluation. And two-thirds, a randomly selected sample of two-thirds of all families whose child screened negatively was invited for a full evaluation. So these are on this slide you see a little bit more information about the characteristics of these families who responded. But it was the same 124 as the responders in the previous slide. The next one. So just to recap, people contacted us. The screening was conducted. Of those who screened positive, we invited them all into a complete evaluation, so that was 53. There was a total of 71 children who screened negative, and we invited two-thirds of those families in for an evaluation, so that was 47. Of the 53 who screened positive, 45 agreed to come in for evaluation, and 45 completed evaluation. Of the screened negative, Of the 47 who were invited, 33 accepted our invitation, and 32 completed the evaluation. So we had a total of 77 children who completed the evaluation. This slide just gives you a summary of the tools that we used as part of the comprehensive evaluation, so cognitive, adaptive behavior, autism symptoms, temperament and behavior, executive function, and the short sensory profile. In order to be determined to have a diagnosis on the spectrum, our approach was basically a developmental perspective. So considering symptom endorsement within the context of the child's overall level of functioning. Two experienced clinicians participated in the child's evaluation in more than 50% of the cases. The clinicians, as part of the process, independently reviewed all available data and completed a symptom checklist based upon the DSM criteria, with each symptom referenced also to specific ADAS and ADIR items. And then clinicians determined a final clinical diagnosis based upon case definitions, which I'm going to skip over the reliability procedures and go right to case definitions. So for autistic disorder, the child obtains a score at or above the spectrum cutoff on either the ADAS or ADIR, and an experienced clinician conducted a thorough case review and endorses six or more DSM for TR symptoms, at least two social, one communication, and one restricted behavior, and that the child's social and communicative impairments were evident prior to age three. So that's for the diagnosis of autistic disorder. For pervasive developmental disorder, not otherwise specified, the child obtained a score at or above the spectrum cutoff on either the ADAS or ADIR. An experienced clinician conducted the thorough case review and endorsed fewer than six DSM symptoms, at least one, but not more than two in the social area, one in communication, and one restricted symptom, and that these impairments were evident prior to age three. So those were the two case definitions that were used. In doing the analysis for prevalence, estimates were weighted to account for the sampling fraction. So remember, we invited only two-thirds of the screen negative group in for evaluation. So the weighting took that into account. 95% confidence intervals were calculated, also taking the differential sampling into account. So what you see here are the findings from the evaluations using the actual number and then the weighted number. So as you see, for autistic disorder, we saw six children. The weighted percentage is 6.5. For PDD-NOS, there were 10 children, and that weighted sample is 11.8. For the total on the spectrum, 16 cases, with the weighted sample being 18.3. So as we look at prevalence of autism spectrum disorder in children with Down syndrome, what you see in this slide shows you in the first row enrolled children with Down syndrome. So that, again, is our from our sample of 77 children, the weighted mean for occurrence of ASD at 18.3. In the second row, what you have is the estimated minimum prevalence of Down syndrome plus autism spectrum disorder. And in this calculation, the denominator was the total birth cohort of children with Down syndrome. and assumed that we identified as having ASD, all dual-diagnosed children in the total cohort. And then for comparison, Colorado participates in the CDC ADAM network. And so what you see in that third row is the prevalence of autism spectrum disorders in 8-year-old children done as part of the ADAM study in 2 Denver metro counties. Next slide. And so in our conclusion regarding prevalence of autism spectrum disorder in children with Down syndrome is that the minimum estimate is 7 times the prevalence in the general population of 8-year-old children. So now I'm going to talk a little bit about our second aim, which was to look at the appropriateness of the screening tools, the MCHAT and the SCQ, with children with Down syndrome by examining sensitivity and specificity. And in using these tools, we screened 85 children with the MCHAT and 39 with the SCQ. 54% of the MCHAT sample screened negative, 46% screened positive. For the SCQ, 64% screened negative, 36% screened positive. When we looked at the screening results against the clinical diagnosis evaluation results, we see this, that and these, again, are the weighted means based upon our sampling. So sensitivity overall, this combines both screening tools, 82.4%, specificity, 59.2%. False negatives, 6.2%, and false positive, 68.9%. The performance, next, for each tool separately is summarized in this next table. So sensitivity for the MCHAT, 75%, SCQ, 100. Specificity, 57 for the MCHAT, 67 for SCQ. False positive for the MCHAT, 74%, and 55% for the SCQ. And false negative, 8% for the MCHAT, and 0% for the SCQ. So based upon the experience of using the screening tools with these children, we feel pretty strongly that probably different scoring algorithms which capture the essential aspects of autism that are qualitatively distinct from developmental delays in social and communication behavior are critical. So looking at particularly sharing affect, responding and initiating joint attention, imitation, social orienting, and using nonverbal behaviors to demonstrate communicative intent. And now I'm going to transfer to Susan Hepburn, who's going to discuss AIM 3 and possibly pick up on some of these recommendations regarding screening tools in her remarks.
Oh, great. Hello, everybody. My name is Susan Hepburn, and I'm a clinical psychologist, and I worked with several clinicians on this project whose efforts we will thank officially towards the end. But this was the kind of project that involved a lot of different clinical opinions, and it was important that we discuss cases because this is not a simple thing. So in AIM 3, we wanted to try to explore the child characteristics that might be associated with having difficulty in social and communicative areas for the kids with Down syndrome who were enrolled in this project. So we looked specifically at cognitive functioning, executive functioning, and problem behavior. To measure cognitive or developmental functioning, we use standardized tests that were appropriate for the child's chronological age. We usually used the Mullen Scales of Early Learning. Sometimes we were able to use the preschool or school-age version of the Differential Ability Scales. For problem behavior, we gathered parental report on the developmental behavior checklist. And to try to get a handle on the executive function abilities, which has to do with cognitive flexibility, initiation, shifting attention, we relied again on parent report through the behavior rating inventory, of executive functioning. So what you see here in this slide is taking a look at the percentage of children in either the group of kids who have Down syndrome but did not receive a diagnosis with autism versus those who had a diagnosis of Down syndrome and autism. And what you'll see is that there is a higher proportion, that's 48.1%, of the kids with Down syndrome have mild cognitive impairments. And conversely, as you look within the category of a severe impairment, which we defined here as having a developmental quotient, a ratio IQ of less than 30, we had more children in the Down syndrome and comorbid autism group that fell in this category. And you can see that the moderate group is somewhat mixed. Now, several researchers in the field have been wondering, perhaps a person with Down syndrome who has a more significant cognitive impairment could look like they have autism, and maybe the developmental issues are driving the social impairment. What this slide is beginning to suggest to us, and this is a relatively small sample in the scheme of things, I suppose, but it's suggesting that not all children who have severe cognitive impairments also have autism, nor is it impossible to be mildly affected cognitively and not have autism. So cognitive probably plays a role, but doesn't seem to account for all of the cases. So when we look at the mean comparisons, we also found a statistically significant difference that those who have comorbid Down syndrome and autism have lower cognitive scores. And as I mentioned, these cognitive scores do not account for all of the cases of diagnosis. Looking then at problem behaviors, we wanted to see if there were any differences in patterns of behaviors, externalizing or internalizing, across these two groups. And what we found, interestingly, no differences in disruptive behavior or acting out, tantrums, that sort of thing. No significant differences in communication disturbance or in anxiety symptoms. However, as we might expect, children with Down syndrome and autism demonstrated poor social relating and had more behaviors which on this scale are described as self-absorbed, which means preferring to play alone or interacting with toys and objects away from others. So as we look at these patterns of behaviors, it's possible that items or concepts that are being captured within the self-absorbed and social relating could contribute to good screening methods, and that seems to make good intuitive sense as well. Finally, when we look at the scores in executive function, different aspects of attention that may impact a child's functioning, what we see is that children with both Down syndrome and autism are reported to have significantly more difficulties in shifting their attention, in maintaining emotional control, and in overall cognitive flexibility, so that higher scores demonstrate more impairment. I think it's also interesting to see that working memory and planning are not statistically different across the two, and those have both been found to be areas of need for children with Down syndrome in general. So as we review these findings and we're trying to develop hypotheses for further studies, it seems as though children with both Down syndrome and autism have more difficulties in some of these executive function areas that we've discussed, and that it's possible that maybe having a combination of conditions might be indicative of a more significant impairment in frontal lobe functioning for a person who has both Down syndrome and autism. But future studies with a larger sample are going to be needed, as well as using better measures of executive function. The brief gives us a good starting point, but a direct observation measure could be really helpful. Now, what I'd like to do now is segue for a moment to show you a movie that we edited together to try to show the various aspects of Down syndrome with and without autism. So this is about a 10-minute film clip. I will pause it here or there, but you'll see headings that basically suggest the child that you will be viewing, and then following that clip, there will be a slide to try to describe either the prosocial behaviors that we saw in watching this child or some of the social and communicative challenges that we saw that made us think that autism could be a part of that person's diagnostic profile. So there's no sound. This is a quiet video. So let's take a look at Max, who did not receive a diagnosis of autism, and watch for his nonverbal behaviors, the way he shares affect, and how he communicates. Now take a look at how Max requests. He's using gestures and coordinated eye gaze to be able to get control of the toy. So what we see there is good social orienting, some sharing affect, directing attention. We have integration of gesture and vocalization and coordinated eye gaze, all good social behaviors that we hope to see in a developing child. Now in contrast, we'll call this boy Peter. He's 6 years old, and he did receive a diagnosis of autism through the project. And we're very grateful to his parents for allowing us to show this video. We'd like for you to look at the same sort of social behaviors you saw with Max and consider social orienting, the way he communicates, the way he interacts with toys, and the way he interacts with people.
Oh, we cannot see Max. Does not show up.
I'm just getting a message here. Is this true that you're not able to see the video? If you're not able to see the video, okay, I guess I'll just try to narrate as it's going. That's very unfortunate. That was an important part. Perhaps we can find a way to archive this for the audience later. What we're trying to show with the videos are these examples of specific behaviors that helped us to determine whether or not a child met criteria for an autism spectrum disorder. If I could know from the facilitator, are there some folks who can see the videos, or is it completely empty for everybody? Because I feel like it wouldn't be worth people's time.
Hi, Susan. This is Carla. Most of the messages that I'm getting says that they can't see the video.
Is there anything we can do to make that happen? Because it says my screen is on.
I think at this point, if narrating is possible, that would be the best way to go.
I'm afraid narrating won't be very helpful. Perhaps I should, I wonder, would it be possible if we turned it over to Rochester, and then is there something that we can do technologically to make it available that I could show it towards the end of the webinar? Because I feel as though the video speaks a lot louder than my narration can.
Susan, this is Sulin. And I think we, in the last time that we had you show the video, there was another application that you had used, and that was able to show it a little bit better. I think we can switch over to Rochester to see if, at this point, to have Rochester give their presentation, and if we are still not able to see it, we certainly can archive it, the video, for folks to access after the webinar.
Okay, that would be good. And I apologize. I'm hoping that we can make the video available. It's our attempt to try to share what looks like symptoms we can attribute to autism, but then also one last point before turning it over to Rochester. The video has helped us think through at what times, if a person has significant developmental delays, when is it meaningful to use an additional diagnosis, and when might it be important to think about how that person's social behavior is actually on par with their developmental level. so that an additional diagnosis of autism is not really relevant. In other words, social communicative functioning in our minds needs to be below the person's overall developmental level. So within the video, we have examples of kids who have impairments, significant impairments in development overall, but do not have autism, and that is something I would love to share with this group. So I apologize for that not working. In conclusion, we were pleased to be a part of this ARTOI project and to be presenting updated prevalence information on children with Down syndrome regarding the absence or presence of autism spectrum disorders. We were careful to apply the DSM-4 criteria in a developmental context, and we learned a great deal looking at the state-of-the-art measures of the ADI and ADOS in this population. And while we see differences in cognitive functioning, problem behavior, and some forms of executive dysfunction, it does seem as though there's much more to explore about within-group variability for the children with Down syndrome who seem to be presenting with an autism spectrum disorder. And we have some ideas and have talked with the folks at Rochester about collaborating and trying to make some improvements, if we can, in the ways that we currently screen kids with these conditions. So we'd like to acknowledge the funders of our study, working with the AUCD and the ARTOI network, and then also we would like to thank our fellow investigators, the epidemiologists and clinicians at the University of Colorado, the Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment, Colorado State University, and the parent leaders and advocates at the Mile High Down Syndrome Association. So I thank you all for your attention, and we'll do what we can to make that video available. I am now clicking on Change Presenter, and I'm sending it over to you, Susan.
The folks in Rochester,
yeah.
You ready to go?
Yes, and do you see our slides?
Yes.
Yes, we do.
This is Susan Hyman. You have to have a collaborator named Susan to be in this project. I would like to start by thanking our entire research group here, including Steve Sulkis and Carolyn Magyar, who are other faculty members, Emily Kushner, who was instrumental as a graduate student, Nancy Roizen at Case Western, and our collaborators at the New York Congenital Malformation Registry. And our specific aims were to look at the prevalence of autism spectrum disorders in children with Down syndrome in a large, diverse population, i.e. New York State, to look at the medical and behavioral characteristics of children with Down syndrome with and without autism spectrum disorders, and as our colleagues in Colorado did, to look at the methods used. We had a slightly different format to our study. We recruited through the New York Congenital Malformation Registry, which requires reporting of a positive karyotype for children born with Down syndrome in New York State. They have a fairly extensive network, a very extensive network, and reporting is required. We recruited through them children born outside of New York City for this particular study. We further recruited from children that we serve with Down syndrome at the University of Rochester, and from family support organizations in New York State, including the Flower City Downs Network in Rochester. This is a schema of what our recruitment was like that we contacted through the New York Congenital Malformation Registry, 1,453 children with Down syndrome, ages 3 to 13 years at the time the study began, born and living in New York State. We had a system of two male contacts followed by a telephone contact from the New York Congenital Malformation Registry. Of that group, that large group of children born with Down syndrome, ages 3 to 13, we successfully recruited 438 for screening level, we called level 1, and because we were not certain which screening test would be most accurate, we actually gave all these children three screening tests. The MCHAT, the Modified Checklist for Autism in Toddlers, which was validated for children under 3, and we didn't know what the mental age of this cohort would be, the SCQ, and we also adapted the questions from the PDD-MRS, the Pervasive Developmental Disorder Mental Retardation Screening, which is a Dutch instrument that was devised for people with cognitive limitations. And that required an interview, so we had slightly fewer children who completed that. Of these, we had 217 children go on to level two. These were children who were positive on a screening instrument and an approximately equal number that were not positive on a screening instrument. And at the second level, the children got an ADIR, a Vineland, and a repetitive behavior scale revised. And at level three, you had an in-person evaluation, including an ADOS. The LIDAR is a nonverbal IQ measure, expressive one-word picture vocabulary test, the picture Peabody, and these were children that were divided between children who were ADI positive and ADI negative. So our data is a little bit different than Colorado's in that we had a large number of children screened, and then at each subsequent level, they're approximately half and half. This is the demographics of our participants. Edwin will talk later about our non-participants. A little over half of our subjects were male. We had an older population. Our mean age was 9, and the majority of children were between 3 and 10 years, with a smaller but significant group of 10 to 13. A large number of our respondents were Caucasian, much larger than you would expect from New York State as a whole. Very small number of subjects were Hispanic origin, and a large number of families had college education or more. I put this in because we had a significant focus on looking at medical comorbidities, because the question that we entered this was whether or not there would be children at medical risk who were more likely to have children who were more likely to have Down syndrome. And looking at the parents' report, a little bit over half of the population responded as having congenital heart disease, and this would mirror what we know about children with Down syndrome in general. However, significant numbers reported vision problems and hearing problems, which may also alter the administration of standard autism diagnostic measures. And at this point, I put up for interest's sake the numbers of children whose parents report the presence of either thyroid disease, celiac disease, and as autoimmune disorders, and the rate of children with seizures. The last item, asthma and reactive airway disease, was put in as a distractor, sort of, and it turned out that a large number of children actually reported as having asthma or wheezing. Now, one of the things that we wanted to point out that is different about this population is the question of regression. That we defined regression on the ADIR as a simple question: did your child lose language or other milestones? And of the children who got the ADIR, the over 200, almost 11% lost language or other milestones, a third lost language alone, and of those children, 11 of 19 had a positive ADIR. So the point is that children with Down syndrome can lose milestones and not have a history suggestive of autism. The other thing that is important to note is that this loss of milestones was often accompanied by a history of medical illness, with seizures, heart surgery, and leukemia being the most common ones. And also that the loss of milestones is reported at a later age than the loss of milestones reported in autism, which is often in the 18 to 24 month range. And we put on this slide for your reading that language loss was at a significantly later age, so that you have to be aware of screening for autism at a later age in these children. So this is the data from our level one screening, and you can see that of the children who participated at this level, that the MCHAT was positive in almost half, and any screen was positive in over half. We separate the children by age, 3 to 10 and 10 to 14, in terms of looking at the rate of positive for these instruments. And the SDQ, as many of you know, is normed for children over four, and it is not specific to mental age. So overall, a large number of children with Down syndrome, as identified in Colorado, do screen positive, so your screening tests alone are likely to over-identify. Here's our level 2 data related to the ADI, that of 216 children who had the ADI, of the subjects that were that received it, 41% almost were positive on the diagnostic algorithm, and 16.7% were positive on the current algorithm. And for those of you who know how the ADI is set up, it's meant to capture symptoms in the 4 to 5 year old age range for children that are older than 5. And for people with cognitive limitations, one of the questions is that 4 to 5 year age range the appropriate time to be looking for symptoms of autism? And as Susan Hepburn mentioned earlier, examining how these instruments work for people with intellectual disability is really very important if we want to examine comorbidity. So we see here that the ADI current identifies a much lower number than the ADI diagnostic, which includes ages 4 to 5. And in our level 3, where these children went on to have the ADOS in addition, so this is a smaller number, total of 76, approximately half of the ADOSs were positive, more likely to be positive in older children than younger children. And we looked at consensus clinical diagnosis in much the same way as Colorado. We've actually been talking through the entire grant funding period so that we would have data that was relatively similar, at least in terms of definition. And we found that the ADOS was really fairly consistent with the interpretation of an expert group of clinicians using all the available data. The ADI and ADOS were both positive in 23 of 76 cases. And compared to the expert clinical diagnosis, the sensitivity of the ADI diagnostic algorithm was 73.5%, specificity 71.4%. The current algorithm was somewhat less sensitive, as you see, but pretty specific, and the ADOS had sensitivity and specificity of around 88%. So with that said, I'm going to turn this over to my collaborator, Edwin Van Wingarden, who will be talking about the data.
All right. So my job today is to provide a broader perspective in terms of how we design these kinds of studies and how do we interpret the findings that have just been presented. So what I'm going to talk about now is basically three questions. Are we estimating the prevalence correctly using some of these screening measures? How can we generalize the findings from New York State or Colorado to the general population in the U.S.? And does the fact that not all families participate in these kinds of studies, does that impact our findings and our interpretation of the results? So from an epidemiologic perspective, ideally what we try to do is to estimate the prevalence of autism spectrum disorders in children with Down syndrome living in the entire United States. Now obviously that's not doable. First of all, we cannot enumerate, or it's very difficult to enumerate all the children living with Down syndrome in the United States. And second of all, we won't be able to have an expert consensus diagnosis for all of these children. So there are two options. First, we can try to take a random sample of these children, which again requires enumeration of everyone in the country. So that's not a very feasible option. And the second option, which worked in our instance, is to take a statewide registry of children living with Down syndrome and try to contact all the individuals, all the families in that registry. So we kind of took a hybrid approach between the probability, or between studying the entire population that we're interested in, meaning the United States, and taking a non-probability random sample of basically trying to take everyone in a registry. So after we identified the individuals, the eligible individuals in our registry, we, as Dr. Hyman mentioned previously, contacted the individuals and sent out screening tools. So what we found with the screening tools is that the SEQ showed positive response on 30% of the children, the MCHAT 48%, and the PDD MRS of 29%. So does that mean that that's the prevalence of autism spectrum disorders in this population? No, not necessarily, and there are certain considerations that we have to discuss. And the first one is, what is your gold standard? Okay, so ideally consensus is your gold standard. In this calculation here, we use the ADIR as the gold standard measure. And things to consider here are the sensitivity and the specificity. The sensitivity means that a 57% here for the SEQ means that 57% of the children with a positive diagnosis using the ADI also screen positive with the SEQ. Okay, so there are 43% of the children screening positive on the ADI, or with a positive diagnosis on the ADI, do not screen positive on the SEQ. And vice versa, the specificity of 93% means that of the 100 children that screen, that test negative on the ADI, 93% also screen negative on the SEQ. So here's an example of 200 children, and 60 of the 200 children screen positive on the SEQ of 30%, which is what we found in our study. Now, of course, some of these children then that screen positive do not actually have an autism spectrum disorder, and vice versa, children that screen negative may actually have such a diagnosis. So first, some children who screen positive do not have ASD. So in this case, 14 out of the 60 children that screen positive do not have an autism spectrum disorder. And likewise, the dark smiley faces here represent the children that screened negative on the SEQ but actually do have an autism spectrum disorder. So when you take away the red smiley faces, which are the false positives, and integrate the dark smiley faces, then what we actually have is a true prevalence of 92 out of 200 children that have an autism spectrum disorder. So the prevalence would be 46%. So you can see, because we did not do the expert consensus or the gold standard diagnosis in everyone, we have to work with some arithmetics and some calculations to estimate the prevalence of ASD in this population. Secondly, another thing to consider is non-response bias. So I believe in the Colorado study, there was 42.5% response rate. In our study, it's about 35% response rate. So overall, 60% of the families that were contacted did not participate. And the question is, well, is the prevalence we find in the 40% that did participate, is that representative of everyone that we try to target, recruit into our studies? So there are several ways you can compute a response rate. We use the bottom one here, where we excluded people we could not contact and people that were not eligible. So in terms of is there any bias in our prevalence estimate, there are three things to consider. The first one is the response rate, and generally people think that when the response rate is lower, the bias in a prevalence estimate will be greater, meaning that the prevalence estimate may not be an accurate representation of the true prevalence. But there are two other conditions that need to be met. The first one is that the factors that the non-responders need to differ from the responders. If they're the same, it's safe to assume that the prevalence estimate that we obtained is similar to the true prevalence estimate. And then finally, if the responders and non-responders differ, the factors that they differ on need to be related to the condition we're interested in, the autism spectrum disorders. Okay, so it's not a low response rate equals a bad study. That's definitely not the case. So we need to consider more things. So what we show here is similar to the Colorado study, is that our participants were higher educated less likely to be Hispanic and more likely to be Caucasian. And that goes for the mother demographics and as well for the father demographics. We have information on education, and they were also more likely to be to have higher education. So, yes, the responders and the non-responders differ in certain respects. On the other hand, from our data at least, there's no evidence that education, race, or ethnicity is related to the prevalence of autism spectrum disorders in this population. So based on that, I would argue that the prevalence estimates that we found are representative of the true prevalence estimates. But certainly that assumption is a little less safe. So in this, what we can generalize to is people, families in New York State that are primarily Caucasian and highly educated parents. Generalizability is a little less secure to other racial or ethnic groups, other states or countries, and perhaps in future populations, as it seems that autism spectrum disorders in general, that the prevalence is going up, so this may not necessarily generalize to the next generation of children. So just to wrap this up on our end here, children with Down syndrome are at high risk for symptoms of autism. The expert clinical assessment with attention to the confounds of developmental level and sensory impairments is necessary for children with Down syndrome. Screening for autism in these children should not be limited to the younger age groups as recommended by the American Academy of Pediatrics, and further research is needed to examine the diagnostic methods for ASD in children with intellectual disabilities. And, of course, thank you to our funder as well as the families who participated in our study.
Great. Thank you so much. At this time, Diana, are you on the line with us?
I am.
Diana, could you provide us with some input, insights, and thoughts on the two studies?
Okay. In the few minutes I have, I just want to make comments on the three aims that these studies tried to achieve: the prevalence estimates of autism in children with Down syndrome, the phenotypic features of these children, and, you know, what are the methods, the best recommendations for assessing children with Down syndrome for autism. You know, it's clear that the prevalence of autism in children with Down syndrome is very high, certainly higher than in the general population. Just in my review of previous reports, there were estimates ranging from, say, 5 to 12% of children with Down syndrome may have autism. I expect that is at least comparable to what's been reported in these two studies, and certainly these studies probably would report a higher rate for autism in children with Down syndrome. And I just had a question. I think I asked this last year, perhaps, if any of the children with Down syndrome actually had a previous autism diagnosis. It would be interesting to know how well this is recognized in the community and these children are getting into appropriate services outside of the study. There was also, a lot of attention was paid on the phenotype in children with Down syndrome and autism, and I thought it was very interesting in the New York study to report on the regression feature in children with Down syndrome, that it may be a feature that should be observed in children with Down syndrome that may be distinct from autism per se. As well as in Colorado, there were children with Down syndrome with autism that had a lot of the autism features, unlike children with Down syndrome alone, you know, problems with shifting attention or rigidity of focus and so on, so that there did seem to be, their conclusion was that there may be a unique phenotype amongst children with Down syndrome that's associated with autism. And I certainly would like to hear the investigators comment on, did you think is there a possibility that this Down syndrome and autism comorbidity or pairing, is there any differences in the autism features in children with Down syndrome that are not shared with other children with autism? So sort of flipping the coin, and if you have any reflections on whether this is a unique autism phenotype that's distinct from children with autism and not Down syndrome. And finally, on your methods and next steps, you know, how do we accommodate the screening or assessments of children with Down syndrome and looking for autism or other behavioral problems as they mature? And I think it was very interesting that in Colorado you were one of your recommendations, which I thought was quite interesting, on developing screeners that are picking up the qualitative differences for developmental delay and social communication capabilities, rather than relying more on those features which are distinct related to social communication impairment that's not related to developmental delay, as well as the New York recommendation that you really, at this point, you really need the clinical assessment as opposed to perhaps relying only on screening or even the diagnostic instruments, that you do need that extra clinical perspective in order to get a valid diagnosis of autism in children with Down syndrome, and also because perhaps, as I understood you correctly, because of the cognitive impairment or developmental delay, you do need to screen children at older ages than perhaps you might in a typical population to assure you identify these children with autism with Down syndrome. And those were my comments. And if the researchers would like to respond to some of my questions, I would be delighted to hear that.
This is Susan Hepburn from Colorado. I thought those questions about the phenotype were very interesting, and we just wanted to share that of the 16 children in our study who received a diagnosis somewhere on the spectrum through their involvement in the study, only one had a previous identification of autism. So that was interesting to us as well. And when we looked back at the histories of these children for intervention, most of them had not received a lot of intensive or direct intervention. Most were involved in programs that had a naturalistic bent in particular, and I found myself wondering if more intensive approaches to building functional communication would be a very, very important place to start. If by the age of 4 or 5, the child does not yet have a way to request verbally or non-verbally, there are some other ways that we might try to promote that communication, and from our conversations with the families, they hadn't actually been able to access those interventions. So I don't know if Rochester had a similar experience or if children are being diagnosed more often there.
No, we had a very, very similar experience. The number of families who wondered about autism themselves but were told by their school districts or others that their child actually did not have autism because they had Down syndrome was really it was a fairly commonplace occurrence in our study. And we were also struck, we didn't present the Vineland data, but that children with Down syndrome were less likely to have adaptive skills that we would anticipate at their cognitive level. And we wondered whether it might not be because of a less intense teaching style in their programs. So that clearly diagnosis has a purpose if a more appropriate educational strategies can be used.
Did you see any features of the autism profile in these children with Down syndrome that you thought were different from other children with autism? Did you see anything unique about the Down syndrome combination?
This is Susan Hyman in Rochester. We went into this and we did the repetitive behavior scale because we anticipated that there would be a predominance of repetitive behavior, and certainly this has been reported by others in clinic-based samples. And we, like Colorado, what we found is that repetitive behaviors were seen in children with lower cognitive abilities, but that really the social difference was more difficult to capture and was certainly distinctive in children with Down syndrome who also have a diagnosis of autism spectrum disorder. So we found less dominance on repetitive behaviors than we really thought we'd find.
And this is Susan Hepburn in Colorado. I think that's an excellent point, that the presence of repetitive behaviors does not in itself indicate an autism spectrum disorder in a child with Down syndrome. We had some topographies of repetitive behavior that we haven't analyzed yet statistically, but it seems as though it may be that moving the hands repetitively by the eyes and visually inspecting toys seem to occur anecdotally, we have to measure it, more often in kids with Down syndrome and autism. The part that I found very striking as we looked at the tapes and reviewed the cases and discussed them within our teams, children who we felt had an autism spectrum disorder, who had Down syndrome, had a very difficult time with any kind of integration, so bringing any two behaviors together. If it's communication, we'd be referring to using a vocalization and looking at a person. If they were playing, being able to sustain attention in play and then shift out of play to attend to somebody speaking with them. And so over and over again, the reason we wanted to begin to look at executive function issues is we found ourselves wondering if part of autism and Down syndrome that might even be stronger than you see in autism alone had to do with that early emerging difficulty shifting and integrating more than one behavior at a time. So that's something that we would like to look at a bit more.
Based on your experience, do you see a recommendation coming into parents and providers of care for children with Down syndrome to have routine screening for behavioral problems such as autism? Do you think?
This is Susan Hyman, and I would say most definitely yes. That what I think both of our studies have demonstrated is the rate of symptoms of autism in children with Down syndrome is much higher than the general population. What we don't know is whether it's higher than children with intellectual disabilities for other reasons. But children with intellectual disability, as evidenced by a recent study in Canada, would have an increased rate as well, so that this would represent a high-risk group.
Folks, let me just pause here for a minute, because I do want to give our audience an opportunity to pose their questions. And Lindsay, could you provide our audience with instructions on how they may pose questions at this time?
At this time, if you would like to ask a question, press star, then the number 1 on your telephone keypad. We'll pause for just a moment to compile the Q&A roster. Again, to ask a question, press star 1. Your first question comes from Marianne Williams.
If I'm understanding correctly, between the two studies, it looks like a large difference in prevalence. I think 46% at Rochester versus 18% at Colorado. I'm just wondering if I'm hearing that correctly, and if so, what accounts for that difference, do you think?
This is Edward from Weingarten. Yes, there seems to be a bit of a difference between the two studies in the terms of prevalence, and I think that may be due partly because of the way the studies were designed in terms of screening the population and then taking a specific proportion or a smaller percentage of children for further screening and how you deal with that statistically. So I think that's one of the reasons. And the other reason may just be that it's truly the difference between the two states. So that's the risk you take when you do a statewide study without taking the entire nation. So partly is perhaps the reason for the difference in underlying population, difference in study design, and difference in statistical procedures to deal with the fact that we didn't perform the gold standard assessment on everyone in our studies.
Yeah, this is Susan in Colorado. We think that's a great question, too, and we'll have some more conversations, I'm sure, across projects. Something we'd want to stress in interpreting our results is that we did use the clinician's diagnostic opinion as our gold standard, and that clinician was taking information from the ADOS and the ADI, but the tool itself, that classification was taken into context, but it wasn't necessarily driving the determination. That could be a difference in methods. In order to make sure we weren't just going with somebody's opinion, more than half the cases we had two different opinions, and we looked at the reliability there as well. And we did find that children who looked like they may have spectrum disorders, in other words, PDD-NOS, those kids were harder for us to get reliable on. It was easier for two independent clinicians to agree on a case of full autism or a case that wasn't anywhere on the spectrum, but it could sometimes be problematic to understand the kids who had bits and pieces of the spectrum. And I think this gets tricky anytime you're trying to do a behaviorally based assessment.
Great. Lindsay, do we have other questions?
You have a question from Renee Damon.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. My question was, we're looking at we're looking at screening using the MCHAT, and our early intervention, Sooner Start is what it's called here, our Birth to Three program, using the MCHAT for children 18 to 30 months. And this is we're going to have a chunk of kids in this group that have Down syndrome. And looking at your numbers, it looked like that's not necessarily going to be a good tool for that population. I just wanted to get your thoughts on that and wanted to ask if you guys had looked at the stat with regards to this population and what your thoughts were on that tool.
That's a great question. This is Susan in Colorado. We piloted the stat. We tried it with, I believe it was four kids, and my former mentor from graduate school is a developer, so I was biased in that direction, to be honest with you. It was a good tool, and I enjoyed watching Wendy Stone develop it. We found that it was a very good tool for that age group. I like it because it includes the sorts of nonverbal behaviors we need to see develop before a child has spoken language. I like that it focuses on affect sharing. And if we think about a child with Down syndrome chronologically being between a year and a half and three, then we need a screening tool that's going to be able to pick up on development that is more in the infant sort of period. Mm-hmm. So those sorts of activities and watching the communicative presses and seeing the child with a parent, I think, is very important as opposed to with an unfamiliar clinician. So that is actually something I would like to do as a phase two, which would be to see how well the stat can perform. And before handing it over to Rochester, I'm sure they have thoughts on the MCHAT as well, we were starting to look at some of the items, and the current list of critical items on the MCHAT definitely over-identified kids with Down syndrome. So an item like whether or not they have maybe the best friend item is from the SCQ. Some of the critical items are maybe not as sensitive as we need for them to be.
Right.
So I feel as though looking for imitation, directing attention, responding to another person's entering the room, a sort of overall social orienting, the kinds of social behaviors that you really want to see in a 10 to 14-month-old child, an infant, would be the ones that I would be trying to focus on, I think.
Okay.
This is Susan Hyman. Just to add to that, the MCHAT was never meant to be a paper and pencil task, that if one follows up the paper and pencil administration with the MCHAT with additional interview, some of the errors inherent in the test can perhaps be redirected. And I think that we want to point out that the MCHAT, to be used in a typically developing population or a pediatric practice, will pick up children who have developmental concerns. The concerns may not be autism. So depending on how you use it in your screening program, they pick up different children than the PEDS picks up as a general screener and requires substantially less skill than the administration of the stats. So it really depends
right.
on what the screening program is meant to do.
Well, and that's the exact kind of conversation we've had back and forth. I just came back from the training on the stat, and so, you know, I too am a little bit biased in thinking this would be a really good fit for the early intervention program here. Our population is not a low-risk population. We're a high-risk population because we're already talking about children that have been referred by their pediatricians for concerns about developmental delays. And so that's exactly the same kind of talks we've been having back and forth is, you know, the MCHAT was really designed for general population, and we're not general population. So thank you. Those thoughts are helpful on that.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Renee. Lindsay, do we have other questions?
We have a follow-up question from Marianne Williams.
Okay.
I wanted to know, in the Rochester study, I noticed that there were a lot of children with vision and or hearing difficulties. And I was wondering your experience of modifying the ADOS for that population of children with those types of sensory challenges and how that went.
So the comment regarding the number of children with vision problems, that was in our screening population. This is the parental report. So in all likelihood, Colorado had the same percentage of vision problems. None of the children that we actually did the ADOS on were legally blind, so that we administered the ADOS in the conventional fashion. But the rate of having vision problems in terms of being quite nearsighted, cataracts, et cetera, and Down syndrome is quite high.
Right.
And we thought it was interesting that this was an extraordinarily large sample of people who were followed in multiple places around New York State, and this rate of medical problems would be interesting to people who care for children with Down syndrome in terms of a more accurate prevalence of medical problems. But we did not, none of the children that we saw were legally blind, so we did not alter the administration.
Okay.
This is Susan in Colorado. We did have the complication of having a few children come in who were not yet walking or who were under a developmental age of 18 months, and both of those criteria are listed in the ADOS as possible reasons for getting a false positive. So I think as the ADOS developers are doing more and more work at creating modules that are good for chronologically older people who may need developmentally younger activities, that could also have a lot of potential for understanding autism symptoms in this population.
Great. Thank you so much. Lindsay, do we have other questions?
At this time, there are no questions.
Okay. Let me just double check with Carla, who is at AUCD and has access to the text messages that some of you may have sent. Carla, do we have any questions from the text messaging?
Yes, I have two questions. And the first one comes from Kathy Harstad. And the question is, do the social and communication differences in children with DS and ASD look somewhat different than other children with autism spectrum disorders?
This is Susan in Colorado. Overall, I don't think that they do. I think that the difference is having to have that developmental context. So, for example, you may have a person, a child in front of you who's 8 years old chronologically, but functioning more like a 3-year-old, then you'd be looking at social behaviors that are more impaired than a 3-year-old would have for an autism identification to be relevant. So I think maybe one of the differences is if you know that a child coming to see you already has a developmental delay, you need to kind of adjust your expectations for the appropriate social and communicative behaviors you'd be looking for. But I felt like overall, if we think about the child's development, the symptoms were pretty consistent between autism and people with Down syndrome who also have autism. Susan, what did you think?
I think that the ADOS is remarkably similar. The ADI, on the other hand, because of the intellectual disability and the lower mental ages of many of the participants, would overread potential social symptoms of autism that may indeed be related to the intellectual disability. And that's one of the reasons why we were quite interested in testing out the PVD-MRS, which was developed for people who also have intellectual disability. So I think that, as Susan Hepburn said earlier, looking at the modules of the ADOS and factor analyses of the historical tests may help us to tease out more accurate ways of picking out people with intellectual disability who also have autism.
Great. Carla, let's take that final question.
Sure. This one comes from Joylene from the Northern Mariana Islands, and she's asking, could arrangements be made in the future for possible collaborative efforts of conducting a study in our region?
So this is Susan Hyman. I'm going to ask Diana Shandell that question.
Okay.
And Diana, just to give you some background, we have, AUCD has centers, University Centers of Excellence in Developmental Disability in territories as well. And the folks from Northern Mariana Islands are participating. It's probably the wee hours of the morning over there, and they've had just enormous interest in participating and listening to the results and the findings from the two ARTOI projects. And so that's sort of a little background on that question.
Could they repeat the question again, please?
Sure. Could arrangements be made in the future for possible collaborative efforts of conducting a study in our region?
Oh, I see. Well, you know, I don't know. Through CDC, that may be a challenge, but certainly we have we've set up an international autism epidemiology network in collaboration with Autism Speaks. Both CDC and Autism Speaks have worked to develop this international group. And clearly, I think that is one effort where you might be able to get support and certainly network with other researchers in the field of autism around the world. And there may be opportunities for getting funding for work in your area through that international network. I know they've recently put out a, for instance, just as an example, an RFA for developing countries to develop a screening and diagnostic tool that's less culturally bound than the ADOS and ADIR for use in a developing country setting. So, you know, if you would like to send me an email, I could certainly connect you with that organization, and you may find that as a, you know, as a useful outlet to get connected with other investigators in this area around the world.
Thank you, Diana. I think, Lindsay, let me just check with you. Do we have other questions?
Again, to ask a question, press star 1. At this time, there are no questions.
Okay, great. I think I'm going to bring this webinar to a close. On behalf of AECD, I just want to thank Dr. Robinson, Dr. Hepburn, Dr. Hyman, and Dr. Van Wingarden, and Dr. Diana Schendel at CDC for presenting, being a discussant on the call, on the webinar today. I want to also thank you to all the participants that joined us. We had about 75 individuals join us on the webinar today, and I think that this is an important topic to many folks within the AECD network and as well as our partner organizations. So thank you again for your attendance. We will be having additional ARTWAY webinars throughout the year. I hope you'll join us. They'll be on various different topics in public health and disabilities. And if you have an opportunity to join us, we welcome that. So thank you to everyone, and have a wonderful afternoon.
Thank you. This concludes today's conference call. You may now disconnect.